Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Norma Walden, a program coordinator of the club's International Relations Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our online and radio listeners, and we invite our audience to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Today's program is Helping the Homeless of San Francisco, What Works? We're pleased to welcome our three panelists who in different ways have given a good deal of attention to this question. Sam Dodge is the Deputy Director of Policy and Communications for the San Francisco Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing. He came to San Francisco after 5 years with the New York City Department of Homeless Services. That was a return to our city for Sam, because he had worked for 7 years in our Tenderloin Housing Clinic as Director of Organizing and Outreach. Sam earned a master's degree in public policy and administration from Columbia University. C.W. Chuck Nevius has been a columnist at the San Francisco Chronicle for over 20 years. During that time, his beats have included sports and movies. He is currently a Metro columnist. Look for his columns on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. Chuck Nevius has written frequently about the challenges facing the homeless and their impact on our city. He's known to many Commonwealth Club members for his appearances on our week-to-week political discussion series. Supervisor Mark Farrell represents San Francisco's District 2, the northwest section of the city, extending from parts of Russian Hill to the edge of Lincoln Park. Born and raised in San Francisco, he was first elected in 2010 and re-elected 4 years later. He serves as chair of the Board of Supervisors Budget and Finance Committee and on 8 other local and state boards and committees. To address homelessness, Mark led the effort to double San Francisco's homeless outreach team and strongly supported Laura's Law, which allows compulsory treatment for severe mental illness. Mark Farrell has hosted many hearings about homeless services. He placed a housing not tents measure on the November ballot. Our panelists plan to speak for about 10 minutes each, and then we'll open the program to audience questions. The panelists are also welcome to ask each other questions. Let's begin with remarks from Sam Dodge.
Okay. Hello, and thank you all for spending your evening with us. I'm always impressed with San Franciscans and our passion to try to turn the corner on this crisis that we see on our streets. And just walking up here from City Hall through the Tenderloin, you know, it's something I work with every day, but the shock of it does not wear off on me, and I hope it doesn't wear off on you either. And this is clearly not the best of all worlds, and we can do much better. And how did we get here? And, you know, we were just having a brief discussion with a woman who helped start the first federal grants in 1983 around homeless services. And, you know, around the difference between the Reagan administration and the Carter administration, there were significant cuts to the HUD budgets for affordable rental housing that have persisted for this 35 years. And we're talking about 600% cuts. And when you do that, by 1983, even, there was a huge explosion of homelessness on the streets of our cities in this country. And at the time, there was a senator, Senator Gore, Al Gore, who was speaking on the Senate floor and said, you know we need to get the funding back to HUD, but in the meantime, we need to pass this McKinney-Vento Act for homeless services. And that McKinney-Vento Act was recently turned into the Hearth Act. And the Hearth Act is part of it, has us all, the communities that want to pull down federal funding for support for shelters and supportive housing, we have to do what's called a point-in-time count, which is a one-night census of our homeless populations in our community. And nationally, the last big count was 2015. The next one's coming up this January. There was a little over 500,000 people on this night that were homeless in the United States. In California, the 1 in 5 homeless people in the country was here in California. We had 115,000. And so this is, you know, it's a dynamic population. People experience homeless, but this is a one night just kind of in amber, everyone that's homeless. And I think, you know, California, we have 12% of the nation's population, but we have a little over 20% of the nation's homeless. And even further, you know, typically when we're working with the homeless, we look at two different kinds of homelessness, a housing crisis and so-called chronic homelessness, long-term homelessness. And here in California, we have 30% of the nation's long-term homeless. Another distinguishing factor of California from the rest of the country, where nationally 30% of the homeless are found unsheltered and 70% sheltered, in California it's the opposite. So it's 70% unsheltered for single adults and 30% sheltered. So here in California's a big state, but San Francisco, our last count was 6,686, which is an estimate, so it's kind of, I just say 7,000, and about half were unsheltered on the street, and half were somewhere in our system of care, whether that's residential treatment, transitional housing, shelters, hospitals, jails. We do a pretty extensive count of any institutional setting where someone may not have come in homeless and not have a solid exit. And so I just say this to kind of frame up what we're up against here. And San Francisco has been a front runner in a lot of the solutions that do work. We've built out a real extensive so-called supportive housing, which combines affordability with on-site support services. And so we have 6,300 units of supportive housing, and we continue to need to grow that. It turns over at about 10% a year, and that combined with new housing that we bring on are the best solutions for those that are chronically homeless, because it's more than just a year or more of homelessness. It's also a disabling condition. And of our population, we estimate that about 1,700 are chronically homeless with a disabling condition and best suited to be housed in our supportive housing. You know, we've also kind of worked to make sure that our services aren't just kind of we open a shop and first come, first serve, but we're trying to go out into the community with a robust outreach team to really target our services for the longest term, most vulnerable people. And part of that was to open a navigation center, which we helped open until a little more than a year ago, and it's helped over 650 people exit homelessness. And that's been really tremendous and a lot of hard work. But part of it is just restricted by how many housing exits we do have. But it's part of a chain of a system so that we can welcome in people at a very low barrier and come as they are, because what we know is that it's very compelling once you're inside, right? That a hot shower, a good night's sleep, good clean food, they help us all in facing life's challenges. And this is what people are experiencing when they're homeless, is an overwhelming crisis. And how we react to that is to exercise the autonomy which we do have. And that creates a place of strength where we can kind of survive the humiliation of facing crises like not having a place to sleep. And somewhat the navigation center, the idea is to really say, you know, you're going to have to change your life dramatically, and we're here to help you. And we want you to come in, but we're not going to here to enforce a lot of little rules. What we're here to do is to help you do the long journey that it's going to take to get back into housing. And so what that's meant for us is a good 28 meetings on average to get your ID, entitlement benefits, work with the case manager, get the applications in, do housing interviews, and to move in finally. One of the great virtues of the Navigation Center is that there is no curfew, that there is no set meal time. There's a 24-hour cafe area where people can get meals ready to eat and microwave and be able to eat them at their time. That, you know, people don't have to be line up. They're able to stay there through the day. It's open 24 hours a day, and the dorms are 24-hour quiet spaces, so people can relax if they don't have appointments to make. Part of the push, so what we were thinking is that, you know, I think that somewhat people had lost faith in the ability for our, you know, service providers and the government to be able to house people that are in such crisis and on the street. And we really wanted to demonstrate that it's absolutely possible and that we have great solutions. People's housing retention, leaving the Navigation Center with the caveat that it's, you know, only been a year and a half here, it's been, you know, over 95%. And so we know just through our other programs too that we have solutions for almost everyone. And if our solutions don't work, we can try them again. And, they, and that often is the trick. And so, you know, how are we going to make progress here? I've described an intervention that works very well for our hardest to serve, most complex cases with supportive housing. And that's our like golden key. But there's a lot of other people that are more in the middle range that don't need all these kinds of stuff. And what we've been piloting is what we call rapid rehousing, which is a time-limited rent subsidies. And we've been had really great success with families because families often in our system are just adults with children. That's what we call families. And they're often not the facing the same kind of crisis that our single adult population are. It's usually an economic crisis that's led to their homelessness. So getting back, getting the help with finding an apartment, a rent voucher that lasts up to 24 months, and what we see is the average length of the rent voucher is between 13 and 15 months. So it's worked really well, and the success rates are well over 90%. And so we know we're not bringing it to its capacity, but we've been working to make more and more investments in that space. And we're bringing that to single adults and especially people in job training programs now. So I think one of the things I'm really hopeful for looking forward is that the ACA, the so-called Obamacare, is creating abilities to pay for the service side of our interventions through Medi-Cal. And, you know, the solving homelessness is a combination of support services and subsidies for affordability or sophistication to find that affordability in a difficult market. And we've seen tremendous success federally and locally with veterans and our efforts around housing veterans. And so we've seen, you know, over 50% drops locally and nationally, 48% drops in federal in veterans homelessness. But it's bringing the support services and medical services from the VA and matching it to grants and subsidies from HUD. We feel like we can replicate that for our chronically homeless and a lot of others by using the ACA and other sources. So at the state level, it's been really wonderful. There's a whole person care initiative, which helps to build out our kind of data infrastructure to integrate with other departments to really have seamless care. There's this health homes initiative to provide the funding for support services and critical medical interventions and psychological interventions for those that need them. And then there's this No Place Like Home initiative, which just passing, which is going to be allowed to bond $2 billion from the Mental Health Services Act, which is a 1% tax on millionaires in the state of California. So I think all together, you start to piece together the puzzles. And how we go from here to where we want to go is going to mean building the system that we want. And the system that we want is a system that says, all right, we understand people are going to have crisis in their lives and may become homeless, but no one should be homeless for more than 90 days. And how are we going to do that? And to build out the right scale of interventions for the different kinds of ways that people experience homelessness, whether it's rapid rehousing, emergency shelter is enough for many, many people, or whether it's this full wraparound medical care and lifetime affordability. So that's what we're working on. We started a new department in San Francisco, and it's like a couple days in here, but 2 weeks in from official. There's various milestones we're kind of working towards. But the mayor has charged us to set up this department in a speech in December, and with the goal of solving the homelessness for 8,000 individuals and the balance of his term. And so we're bringing in programs that have been managed by five different departments under a common banner. And, part of this is to take advantage of these opportunities and to really use focus as we move forward. So that's what we've been working on.
Go ahead, Monica.
Go ahead. Okay. First of all, good evening, everyone. It's nice to see you all here tonight. I'm going to start off by saying, in case this is ever watched on recording, my wife watches it. Happy anniversary to my wife of 13 years today. She was gracious enough. Yeah. Gracious enough to let me come here this evening. Bonus points, right? In terms of the issue at hand, homelessness has always been a major issue in this city. As was mentioned before, I was lucky enough to be born and raised here in San Francisco. I remember the issue very much growing up in our city, whether it be at the local park. Certainly, growing up as a teenager, was the panhandlers along Van Ness at every single corner, if those of you who have been around here remember those days. But it's always been a very major issue in our city, and I think it affects people in many different ways. For some folks, it is a public safety issue. People sometimes feel threatened, vulnerable around our homeless population. For a lot of people I've talked to as well, it's a civic pride issue. When you hear visitors come and say, I don't want to come back to Warrior City because either I felt threatened or I don't believe the status of your city, that is certainly something that affects people in a major way. My wife and I, with our three children, we were just up in Tahoe on vacation, came back, met someone up there who had been on a chairlift in the ski season with someone from Mexico City. And this individual had come to San Francisco, and they said, well, what do you think of the city? He said, well, it was a really great city, but the homeless are unbelievable. And that's someone coming from Mexico City. And I happen to travel there for work a few times a year, and it's really bad down there. But when you have people coming from second and third world countries and coming to the city of San Francisco and remarking what an issue it is, I think it just reemphasizes once in a while, actually, that's very real. It's not just our own perception as we walk down the streets in our city. I think, but ultimately, though, this is a human issue. Right? These are mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters, sons and daughters that have, for whatever reason, fallen on hard times. And I think we need to keep that in mind as we think about approaches and policy ways to solve or to work on the issue at hand. As an elected official, I started working and diving into the homeless issue about 3 years ago, perhaps a little bit longer. Believe it or not, no one in City Hall was talking about it my first 2 years in office at all, despite the fact that it continues was still a major issue. Very visible in our streets. And I started off by holding, as was mentioned before, about six different hearings on the topic. Really ticked some of my colleagues off how much time of theirs I took. But I thought it was really important to dig into the different issues here. We were able to pass Laura's Law, which was a major issue in our city. Prior times at the Board of Supervisors wasn't able to even come for a vote, and we were able to maneuver it such that it would pass on a 9-2 vote here in San Francisco, which was a good step forward. We doubled our homeless outreach team, as was mentioned, quadrupled our budget for a project called Project Homeward Bound, where if we can find a loved one on the other end of the phone line willing to take someone in, we give that person meal money and transportation money to go back home. It was met with significant success ratios. I believe it's 1 year later, 70-80% of these individuals are still housed with the same people, finding employment. So projects like that, I do believe that we need to look not only internally at San Francisco what we can do, but we need to look at other cities, other jurisdictions internationally, what they're doing on the topic, and really emulate here in the city what we can. We also were able to pass some strict laws around our affordable housing providers in the city, making sure that they start to report eviction statistics. Because believe it or not, some people were getting kicked out of San Francisco subsidized housing for not paying 1 month's rent. They're back on the streets. In order for the city to recoup that money and then get them back into housing, it's a very expensive proposition. And so we started putting some policies in place that really start to loosen those restrictions to make sure we keep people housed more than anything else. We don't want to exacerbate the issue by putting people who are currently in city-subsidized housing because they were homeless back on the streets because they missed a month's rent. We need to make sure we think really smart about those issues. But ultimately, though, I will say this is a very, very political issue. And I say that from my position on the Board of Supervisors. And I think Sam and Chuck would both very much agree with that. Everyone agrees that homelessness is a problem. Nobody agrees what the solutions are. And that's where the politics come into it at the end of the day. You know, there's a reason our former mayor, Willie Brown, who still writes a column for the Chronicle, told me originally, he said, you know, this is a political loser of a topic to take on because there's no real answer and there's no silver bullet, which is true. However, I don't believe that's an excuse to stick your head in the sand and to ignore the issue. To me, that's worse. I think as elected officials, we need to be there to address the issue. Like my policy suggestions, don't like them, that's fine. But I believe it's our obligation for issues that affect our residents to tackle them head on and to suggest things that may be bold, may be normal, but that really move the needle forward. Personally, you know, Sam mentioned a few things along this regard. I do believe that we need to approach this issue first and foremost with compassion, but I also think we need to not be afraid to enact policies that disincentivize homelessness in our city, that really push people to get off the streets and onto their own 2 feet. That does meet with a lot of political resistance in town, but I do believe that we need to do and really enact those policies moving forward as a city. And Laura's Law is a great example and many others that we could talk about. There are three things I'll mention, though, just as food for thought tonight. First of all, I do believe we have a housing first policy here in San Francisco. And I do believe in that very much so, in that we will, our first job is to really provide and to get people into housing. It sounds trite, but the simplest solution to really working on homelessness is to get people housed and off the streets. But the cities have met with great success in this issue. Salt Lake City is turned to as an example. Houston is turned to as an example. Think about the cost of housing in those cities versus the cost of housing in San Francisco. So the cost of housing in our city not only affects people who are housed now and the mission being inflated and across every economic strata of our city, but it affects how much the city has to pay to rent a room for homeless individuals to go to. So it's a very, very expensive proposition in our city. And as much as we all agree with the housing first policy in our city, we also very much get criticized at times for the amount of money that we spend on the homeless issue in our city. This year was close to $250 million out of our city's $8 billion budget. And I say that as the chair of our Budget and Finance Committee for the last 4 years. But over 50% of that money goes to housing existing homeless individuals and keeping them housed. So what would we do if we cut that budget? Would we put them back out on the streets? I would suggest that we need to continue to house them and find ways to get them on through their own 2 feet. Secondly, San Francisco versus other major cities. You know, you can look at our homeless population from, Sam mentioned these point in time count. For the past 10 years, our homeless population has remained relatively static, meaning the number has been about the same, around 7,000, give or take a little bit. Statistically speaking, it's pretty amazing. I was poked fun at earlier this year because when we did the homeless count, my wife and I actually participated in that and did that. And I think one of your fellow columnists in the Chronicle called it date night at the Farrell household to go out and participate in the Farrell and the homeless count. It wasn't you, Chuck. It wasn't. But it's an, you know, I did it because, first of all, I wanted to see what it really entailed to get involved in the issue, but also to really be part of it. When you say we've had we were 7,000 people were homeless 10 years ago and about the same number today, you can look at that and say that's actually doing pretty good. Because in other major cities, whether you think about Los Angeles and Skid Row and how that's evolved over certainly the last few years, and Seattle and New York, we've seen major upticks, over 20% in all of those cities, in homelessness just in the past 2 years. But I don't think anybody will look on the streets of San Francisco and think that the status quo is acceptable or okay at all. But it's interesting when you look at San Francisco compared to other cities and the things that we are doing. Are they working? Or are we just not doing enough of them or putting enough resources behind that? And I think it's an interesting question to ask. And then the last one I'll mention is a myth that I have heard quite a bit, that homeless individuals come to San Francisco because of the great services we offer, that homeless individuals are market-driven. Well, I hear it a lot. And the one thing that really knocked me off of that topic was the group that does our homeless point-in-time count does it in other jurisdictions as well. So they have a bit of an expertise in this issue. In Las Vegas in the summer, I think they did it about 4 years ago, when the temperature turns to 125 degrees and people are you're really cooking the eggs on the street corners, the homeless population remained exactly the same as in the winters in Las Vegas. So whereas you think you might take a quick bus ride or a train down to San Diego and have a little bit of better weather just because it's close enough and probably cheap enough, people generally don't do that. However, in San Francisco, so I would subscribe to that. I don't think people come to San Francisco, become homeless in San Francisco, or are on our streets because we offer such great services. But I would suggest that there are some people right now that are proposing policies, and I'm happy to answer any questions about them at the Board of Supervisors, that would actually cause that to happen. And I think that's very dangerous, because I think we have a tough enough time dealing with our existing population here in San Francisco. Obviously, we don't have borders. People will come here as they will. But we need to focus on the individuals that are homeless on the streets of our city right now, stem the tide of new people becoming homeless on our streets, whether it be through rapid rehousing or making sure we don't make San Francisco an attractive place to come for that reason, and then really dedicate the resources to the people on our streets tonight, today. So anyways, a few things for thought. Again, I think this is an issue that affects all San Francisco residents. It continues to show up number one, along with public safety, is the issue that matters most to San Francisco residents. So I want to thank the Commonwealth Club for putting the panel together tonight, and I look forward to the discussion.
So this is a great example of why you should read your emails all the way to the end, because I didn't realize I was supposed to talk for 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. So I said earlier, my premise was going to be to say, I agree with Mark and Sam, whatever they said. I know homelessness is an important problem, and I think one of the things that in San Francisco we have to think about is it may be our most visible problem. We do have problems, and there's many things we have to do, but the fact that there are people all those times, if I could just share a quick story. I drive my wife to work every morning about 8 o'clock. We drive up 3rd Street. We cross Market. We take her to the Financial District. We're waiting for the light to change at 3rd and Market, and this guy runs into traffic. And we're going 3 miles an hour just to roll up, and he's yelling, he's screaming, he's ducking in and out of traffic, and for some reason, he came over in front of our car. And he looked at both of us, and he screamed. And then he came around to the side and punched the side mirror and shattered it. And I, like you, thought, how is it possible that we have someone who is so clearly troubled on the streets of San Francisco, and we can't do anything about it? And I can tell you that in my job, we look into those things and we find out it's incredibly complicated. It's incredibly difficult to get these people, those people who are absolutely having psychotic episodes, help. And that is so difficult to see day in and day out. And I know that you walk the streets of San Francisco and you see it and you say, come on, we can do better. And frankly, Laura's Law is a great step in that direction. And we have other things that we can do. And as Mark said, we had a 10-year campaign against homelessness. We started with roughly 7,000 homeless people. 10 years later, we had 7,000 homeless people. And it makes you think we're not getting anywhere. But I will say that the one thing I have not heard in San Francisco is we're giving up. Sam said we've kind of lost faith. I think we're just concerned. But we need to find a way to address people. And I would say, as a freelance gadfly who just gets to say whatever he wants and not worry about election, Mark, I think we can't treat homeless as a one-size-fits-all. And to start with, it is the people who are on the street who are barefoot, who are yelling at the sky, who we need to find a way to reach. And I know, and God knows, Sam's group and the HOT team, they're working on it. But we need to find a way to say these people really are a danger to themselves and to others. And unfortunately, what's happened in San Francisco is we've cut back on emergency psych beds for those people who are clearly having psychotic breakdowns. We need to find a way to put those people together. And second, I would say families, and particularly women, single mothers, we've got to do something for them. There's no place more dangerous than the streets. And third, I would say veterans. And there's two reasons for that. One, they served our country. And second, I'll bet they've got a lot more benefits. So that's an opportunity. Now, there's one other thing that has happened, and I was just at a community meeting last week with Jeff Kaczynski, who's the new homeless czar, who I have a lot of faith in. This is one of the first times, no offense, Sam, this is one of the first times that I really feel like we're on the right track. We've got something going. But one of the things that he said, and one of the things that we heard from these neighbors was, in the last year, in the last 12 months, we're seeing so much more crime. We're seeing a whole different group in these encampments. And several people mentioned, it's not just the residents. It's not just the business owners. Some of the older, chronically homeless people are being preyed upon, too, by these same people. And one of the undervalued economic moments that's happened is heroin prices have gone way down. And in a lot of cases, we have a problem in this country with people on prescription drugs, with opiates. We have done all we could. We've gone after those people. It's been effective. But what they've done is they've gone to a substitute. And it's available on the streets of San Francisco. The problem is, as we know, you've got to have a fix every day. And to do that, you have to have money. And if you're probably not spending your time working a 40-hour work week, you may have to resort to crime. And I know that Jeff Kaczynski is interested in this, and I know that Mark is interested in this with the encampments. And frankly, Sam is not someone who is an apologist for this kind of behavior. So the criminal part of it has to be addressed. So it can be everyone in San Francisco. And again, I have never heard in San Francisco, let's give up. We can't do this. We're not going to be able. San Francisco is trying. It's working towards solutions. And it can happen, but we just have to find some way to make it work. We can't say you can't stay on the street unless we have a place to put them. And that's going to be the issue. It's just going to be the issue. But I really am, and I really feel like we're doing the right thing. And up and down the West Coast, it's not just San Francisco. There's a homeless problem in a lot of places, and it's a difficult problem. But again, I am not a pessimist, I'm an optimist, and I agree with Mark and Sam. I just want to say that. Thank you.
You know, maybe a few things I'll just add as the moderator comes back up. Two things, actually. First of all, we talk about the same number of homeless people on our streets, but it is, as Chuck mentioned, become a lot more visible. And I would suggest that all of the development that's happening, in particular south of Market, the high rises going up and so forth, that is displacing a significant amount of people that were previously homeless in those areas. During one of my first jobs in the city after grad school, I used to park where is now going to be the new Transbay terminal. And there was a tent city there of 200 people that we didn't pay much heed to, but I would suggest that it's becoming a lot more visible because they are being displaced and put in different parts of the city, so they come into people's neighborhoods a lot more, and it's a lot more visible. And also last second, I'll just mention real quick, in terms of this Housing First discussion, I actually had a study done by our budget legislative analyst inside of City Hall, and it came out about a month and a half ago, that clearly identified over the course of a few years, housing people is cheaper for the city than it is to treat them on the streets because of their need for emergency care and other type of medical interventions. So think about that as we talk about this topic, and I think it's really food for thought going forward for policymakers that it is cheaper ultimately to house these individuals over the long term than to treat them on our streets.
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program at the Commonwealth Club of California about helping the homeless of San Francisco, what works. We're speaking with three panelists, Sam Dodge, Deputy Director of Policy and Communications for the San Francisco Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing, Mark Farrell, Supervisor of San Francisco's District 2, and CW Chuck Nevius, columnist with the San Francisco Chronicle. We'll now begin our audience questions. We have a microphone there in the back, so please use the microphone if you can so that your question will be recorded. If someone cannot get out of their seat, raise your hand, and someone will bring you a microphone. Okay, Karen, please proceed.
I want to thank you so much. This is a subject that's very dear to my heart, and I have two questions. The one about the people selling off housing to developers or people like those two elderly women who were being put out, and they had nowhere to go. And one ended up dying in her 90s because the stress was so great, I think. So how can you, especially you, Mark, how can you stop the closing of a lot of affordable housing for people? And the second one was when Reagan shut down a lot of the mental hospitals in California, there was no place for the people to go. And if they are put into getting help for the weekend or something, 3 days, then they're put back on the street. Why don't we open up more mental facilities that are long-term that help the people? I think that the Navigation Center has some help like that, but where's the long-term help for the mentally ill? I think a third of the population is mentally ill, for all three of you.
I'll address just the first one you talked about. The individual and the elderly who were being evicted and one passed away. That is actually less about it. I mean, it relates to homelessness, but that's more about just evictions here in San Francisco and I think of housing policies. We have a state law called the Ellis Act that allows certain landlords to do certain things with their buildings as they permit. What we have seen, though, during the housing boom, if you will, over the last few years, are new people coming in, buying buildings, mm-hmm. kicking people out, and then redoing them, rehabbing them, selling them off, or what have you. And so that's a whole separate topic around housing and eviction prevention that we have tackled ad nauseum as much as we can at the Board of Supervisors and inside of City Hall. I think we've put almost as many restrictions in place as possible. Many of the things that we've done have actually already been struck down by the courts. So we're doing as much as we can as a city. But I think given that state law continues to exist, and there are pros and cons to that state law, mind you, I don't want to say that it's entirely a bad thing, but the way it's construed right now, I think we are a little bit hamstrung on doing anything more, but those numbers of evictions have dropped significantly from what we've seen 3 or 4 years ago. But, you know, look, if you hear one story like that, it sticks in your mind, and you remember it, and you think it's an issue, because it is.
I think your second question, it talks to the state. And so the Ellis Act is a state law. It needs to be reformed to the state. And the mayor spent a lot of time working with Senator Leno to try to reform that. It came very close, but a lot of Democrats defected. And, you know, real estate money is really big in the state. And he wasn't able to ultimately succeed. But then again, at the state level is where we've seen these huge cuts in the mental health services as well. And it's hard to resurrect those kinds of levels here locally. I mean, you know, we talked about the $250 million that's spent on homeless services with $120 million of that for people that are formerly homeless, just to be clear, and another $50 million for health services. And it really comes down to around $50 million that we're spending annually for people that are currently homeless. The behavioral health system that we have in this city for people that in addiction crisis, mental health crisis, is well over $300 million. And so sometimes we're conflating when we're talking about what's happening on the street and the interventions that are needed. I'm talking about a pretty straightforward system about rehousing people and providing support services, but there's clearly people that these issues that go far beyond housing and that need those kinds of interventions. And, you know, I would welcome that. I'm, you know, part of the psych emergency room we have at General, the problem they have is how to discharge. It's like a very high level to get someone into guardianship and into institutional level, but oftentimes people, if they can orient to the world and can say they know how to feed themselves, even if it's out of a garbage can, they'll discharge right to the street. And that's really heartbreaking.
I would just say, concerning evictions, there was an interesting story in the New York Times, I don't know if you saw it, but Brooklyn, which you know, is the new Oakland, or Oakland's the new Brooklyn, one of the two, I can't remember which one it is, experienced this building boom, and they put an enormous number of apartments online. And they are now lamenting the fact that rents have stabilized and that people are having a difficult time renting these places, and they're giving months of free rent because there are so many housing units. Then this runs, of course, into the dichotomy in San Francisco, which is, as Carl Nolte, our columnist, said, everyone says, San Francisco was perfect the day I arrived, and I don't want anything to change. So we have to decide if we're going to be able to build, if we're going to be able to go vertical. I know that's a dirty word, but we may have to do some of those kinds of things. And the people who say supply and demand doesn't work in San Francisco, I don't see it. I think it would if we could give it a try. It has to be smart. There has to be affordable housing. We're up to 25% now affordable, which will be interesting to see if it works for developers, if they're able to make money or not. But again, it's not as if we're ignoring it. We just need to move on.
Thank you. I appreciate all the all three of your comments and focus on compassion. I'm particularly impressed and encouraged to hear Sam speak of how integrated many of the service offerings are that have been needed for a very complex issue. My question is around choice and autonomy for the homeless, and I was privileged to tour the Kroc Center in the Tenderloin, a couple of years ago, and, you know, a beautiful, clean, secure, multi-service program, and amazingly, a very significant number of the lovely rooms are not being taken advantage of because the requirement is that one night of doing drugs or alcohol and you're removed from the program. So how do we solve something that we want choice and autonomy? It was interesting to hear Chuck speak of Laura's Law or Mark speak of Laura's Law. But how do we have compassion and also respect choices that are destructive? And I don't have an answer to it. What do you think?
So the program you're describing is a Salvation Army program. And, you know, we've been working really closely with Salvation Army to try to see if they can take some of their programs and take some of the evidence-based best practices that we know work, like harm reduction and housing first. And some of these ideas, maybe they're too worn out, but those names, but the idea is that, you know, when people come in and they're facing substance abuse crisis, that having a secure place to live, we see people drop their substance abuse quite substantially. But, you know, part of recovery, and for those that have experienced it or have family members who experiences it, it's relapse. You know, it's a journey, right? It's not just you flip the light switch and you go. There, we need to have choice and autonomy in our system so that there are sober living places in our system. And I think the Kroc Center does provide some of that. But I think when we're working with people that are facing multiple crises in their lives, we also need to work with them for the long term and see, you know, if we can not just have one strike and you're out kind of policies. And so I think the vast majority of our housing is not based on the sobriety rule, and the units that they have there tend to have more vacancies than the rest of our system. But part of the choice, there needs to be some sober living choices in our system. And so I would say that that has that virtue to it as well.
I just add, I think this a little bit gets to the homeless population on our streets is not a homogeneous population. You know, one size doesn't fit all. You know, I think for a lot of people, why the Navigation Center has worked so well is because you can bring your dog, you can bring whatever, which previously, if you told someone, if I'm on the streets and I have a pet and I have a shopping cart full of belongings and you say, come to bed, I'll find you a shelter for a night on a room that's not that great, and everyone knows it, but it's shelter for one night or a few nights, but I won't guarantee you anything more, but you have to ditch your entire belongings and your pet on the streets. A lot of people proactively just say no to that. And so we have to find, for those individuals, we have to find places where they will welcome coming off the streets, and we can work on that together. And those, I think the Navigation Center represents that. But there are also people that choose proactively to live on our streets as a lifestyle as well. And for those people, we have to have, I think, you know, more of a stick than a carrot, if you will. And so to me, that's where we have to have policies that disincentivize being on the streets, if you will, during for certain people. So I think it's a great question. I think it's something everyone struggles with, but I think there's really, it depends on who you're talking about, and I think having options for both is really important if you really think about a system-wide solution.
And I honestly didn't believe when I first started doing this that you would go out to someone on the street and say, we have a bed for you, and they would say no. And yeah. I went out with the homeless outreach team, and they said no. And for very much, you know, what Mark said, not just a pet but a partner. But I've had people say, to be honest, I really enjoy getting high. I stay out here. I'm with some people I know. I've formed a community. I don't want to go in. And I think that's the deal. It's the option. The shelters, frankly, are a very difficult option. You've got to wait in line. You've got to go there early to get a bed, and then you spend the night, and then you're out early the next morning. And where are you going to go next? Back in line and wait for the same bed in the it's a zero-sum game, and we need to figure a way to make that work, and it isn't right now. And I think the Navigation Center is a great idea. We need to find a way to treat people as people, and yet I think we also have to have some standards and say you can't prey on other people. There are things you have to do, you have to be able to do. So delicate balancing act, again, I think we're moving in the right direction, but it certainly is a difficult and thorny problem, continues to be.
I occasionally take Caltrain down the peninsula to San Jose and drive along El Camino. And along much of the route, I see numerous down-at-heel motels in kind of down-at-heel neighborhoods, Brisbane, Mill, and so on. And given that homelessness is not a San Francisco issue, but a regional and statewide and federal issue, and since San Francisco lacks housing, should San Francisco lease or buy some of these near-derelict properties, and repurpose them for some of the homeless? Is this realistic?
Yeah, it is realistic. And I think it's, until recently, it's been kind of taboo. But we've, you know, I mentioned those rapid rehousing vouchers.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
We, you know, end up using 70% of them through client choice and what's available for what is realistic rent level to get to, that families have looked to outside the city and county and found good housing that way. And I think this has really just kind of helped open our eyes that, you know, like many families working and like myself, actually, I live in Oakland. I mean, it's just the options, and it's what I can do for my wife and two kids, it was a better solution. And so I wouldn't deny that to any homeless family as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that we need to look at that, because the opportunity cost is, you know, I want, you know, maximum affordable housing here in the city. And I think there's a lot of really compelling health reasons and gender acceptance reasons and others, mm-hmm, that we should have lots of spaces in the city for people that need it. But the opportunity cost, if I can only get units here for $1,000 a month, and I can get them for half that or much less in nearby regions on transit lines, I mean, that's a not something that I'm willing to give up. So it's You know, we have to find dollars that allow for that. The federal dollars and the state dollars that we pull down doesn't allow us to move outside of the county currently. Mm-hmm. So we have to look for partnerships in nearby municipalities. But Oakland has said point blank that they would love to do projects jointly with us. Okay. So,
thank you very much.
Sure.
And Sam, aren't there a number of SRO, single-room occupancy hotels in San Francisco that the rooms are available, but they're not being used?
Yeah, there's weird cases. I mean, San Francisco has 522 residential hotels and about 18,000 to 20,000 people that are living in residential hotels. This is evident by our neighborhood here. And every once in a while, I'll get one that's been closed for a long time or something like that, and I can figure out a way to lease it or purchase it. But it's running out, and in order to be economical for us, we have fixed costs when we're running a supportive housing in a residential hotel with a desk clerk and service staff. It's better if I have 100 or more units, but as I start going under, the cost viability starts to go way down. So there's still some opportunities we're able to do. I brought on 530 units last year in residential hotels. Revamped and really nice, proud places that people can come off the streets and live. And this year, it looks like we're going to be able to do 330. But there's some limits. I mean, there's ultimately, we kind of take the best buildings and some point where you kind of need to build new or look outside the county.
Good evening. Very much appreciate your policies and opinions. So my first is a clarification. Sam, I think you'd mentioned that there were 7,000 units of temporary transitional housing that's currently available, and then we mentioned that there are 7,000 homeless over the last 10 years that hasn't changed much. So I just wanted to see, are there 7,000 more homeless than the housing we have, or is it just in between? So that's a clarification that I'm hoping for. The second one is that, for all intents and purposes, our panelists represent what would be considered the establishment to some extent. And so my question would be, if you could channel those who are not in the establishment, what do you think they would say are the causes of our epidemic? And then how would you collectively, what do you find are the biggest impediments or roadblocks to solving this epidemic? Thank you.
Yeah, I'll try to go fast. So. Their point in time count is for people that are in shelter or on the street. Our permanent supportive housing, 6,300 units, are filled with people that are formerly homeless and turn over a little bit each year. And it's a separate group of people. We count the money in the same bucket, which drives me crazy, but it's the convention of our town and our newspaper, so I kind of like have to go along with it. In our budget office, I should say. So it's my own kind of thing. I think, you know, to channel the activists, it's, you know, we have a housing system here in this country that has automatic entitlement to mortgage deductions on not just your primary house, but your beach house and, you know, multiple houses. And it's bigger for the bigger size of your loan. So it ends up subsidizing more and higher income people. And we have scarce resources for those that are living without shelter. And they get lotteries and long lines and scarcity methods. And that until there's an entitlement for like a Section 8 voucher for people that are extremely low income, we're going to be kind of in this space of dealing with crisis and managing scarce opportunities.
I think to add to that, you know, we mentioned the 7,000 people that are currently homeless. But in that 10-year period of time, we've housed 22,000 homeless people. We've sent home through Homeward Bound close to 10,000. So I would suggest that if we hadn't done those things, our homeless population would be astronomically larger. So it isn't the same 7,000 people at all, right? We've cured a lot, but more and more come onto our streets, either in San Francisco or move here. That's number one. You asked about the outsiders. What I hear the most, personally, and I shudder being called the establishment, but fair enough, fair point, is that we're spending so much, but it's still such a big problem. And what I have come to realize as the fiscal conservative inside of the Board of Supervisors and otherwise, that this is probably the most expensive problem we have to solve. And that it is also always looking at new policies, ideas, and new priorities. But again, compared to other cities and what we've done, I think what we're doing is working. We're not doing enough of it if you really, truly want to make a dent in the issue. There's no way it's the same budget and we're gonna be able to rent more rooms or what have you. You just can't. It's impossible. You can't do that. So I think the biggest, from my perspective, outside impediment is people look at our budget and say, you're spending so much and it's still such a big problem. It's not that we're not spending enough. It's that you guys don't know what you're doing with the money that we're spending. And that's, I think, a sentiment that is very difficult to overcome.
I would just say, you know, we may be the establishment here, but if we were in Kansas City, we'd be communists. So, you know, the discussion has become so fraught and it's so difficult. And one of the things we've talked to some of the advocates. I've certainly done it, and I've broken the third wall or the fourth wall, whatever it is. And I've said, look, I understand that you're passionate about this, and that makes all the difference in the world. And God bless you for doing it. But if you take a group like yourself, who is saying no all the time, and you take a group like, to pick an example, the Bicycle Coalition, which is no one is more rabid about their cause, but the Bicycle Coalition has found a way to work through compromises. And I've said, you can't just say no. What's the yes? What is it that you'd like to see that would be a yes? We're ready to get behind that. And I've even said, if you want to take me on a tour of the shelters to show the lousy conditions there, I'm ready to go. And the response I got was, nothing is ever achieved without force. You've got to, and that, I think, is the point where we're at loggerheads with, we want to solve this, everybody wants to solve this, but it doesn't have to be an argument to how we're going to solve it. And that's what it seems to have degenerated into. And that, I think, holds us back.
Hello. So my question is based on the assumption that both the homelessness problem as well as the homeless population is not homogeneous, right? So the two parts to this question are on one end of understanding the problem and on the other end of providing solutions for the problem. So with different forums and different conversations, I hear about funding and units and numbers of people, but I very rarely hear about actual research to understand the problem. So my question is, what's kind of budgeting or actual initiatives do we have from a research perspective to better understand the problem? Like as an example, from an anthropological study perspective, as opposed to, it's kind of alarming when I hear things like creating disincentivizing policies with, as an example, using numbers based on like point and count. So on one end is what kind of initiatives, research initiatives, and also budget is set aside to understand the problem? And on the other end is, should we actually have solutions? Is there a venue or is there some kind of forum or a particular kind of place that can live through, office terms for us to suggest solutions and consequently to kind of pool from that to contribute to solving the problem?
So in our department, we have a fair amount of analysts, which help to kind of oversee the programs of the departments and to help manage the contracts. I think it's a little bit different than research institutions like UC Berkeley, where I had an anthropologist just in bed with my office. I used to run this office called the Office of Hope, and it was an advisor to the mayor office. And part of his anthropological work was to look at the different forces and the decisions that are being made to kind of manage marginality and scarcity around the homeless population and solutions. And so, yeah, I was connecting him with our patrol officers and with our public works people and with our homeless outreach team. And then he was also kind of helping to, follow me and kind of look at some of the decision-making kind of meetings and stuff that we have to go into, because It is a really, so that's just for anthropology, as you mm-hmm. say. I work very closely with researchers, national researchers at University of Pennsylvania. It's Dennis Culhane and his shop creates some of the best research nationally. And I also work closely with our other fellow county people that are working on homelessness to share our data and research and best practices. And so, you know, altogether, it does really add up, and it's helpful. I do believe that that helps us work. I'm on the leadership council for the National Alliance to End Homelessness, and they help fund some research, and we help supply data. I mean, clearly, this summer, there was a large kind of push for 70 media outlets to do a deep dive into homelessness, and so I was having to help the reporters there access information from that we have administrative data and research that we've done. But a lot of the research and evaluation in the bigger reports that's been done is done through our controller's office mm-hmm. and through the budget legislative analyst's office. And so they do reports on this issue annually, but this year was, I think, maybe a record for the amount of reports. And so wow. I'm having to help them understand the issue and our various programs and where they can get data and help them understand this, because they're often researchers that are you know, working on many issues. So I do spend a lot of my time helping research and get the data out there. I don't know if that's...
Yeah, I would just suggest that... there are a lot of different places that do research. That we have a controller's office, budget legislative analyst. We also rely on some of our service providers that, you know, look at, for instance, that provide homeless services for LGBT community, which is a big part of our population in San Francisco, statistical information about that. And so it comes from a myriad of sources. There is no one central repository, if you will, if that's even a kind of maybe what you're even getting at, that either exists today or, to your second question, would exist through time. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a great question, because I think that would be incredibly useful. Mm-hmm. But then again, it's who's resourcing it, who's staffing it, and, you know, kind of what is their core function. And, you know, to Chuck's point just a second ago, this gets so political. Mm-hmm. As an example, if some of you might have read about it, I put what is now Proposition Q on the ballot for this November. That's our Housing Not Tents initiative. And it basically says that the tents that are on our street encampments or tents on our residential sidewalks are illegal. And we're going to go through and take them down only if once we have individuals and we have shelter or housing for these individuals. Hmm. Right? And we're not going to take away tents and say good luck. We won't do that. To give you some background on the tents, just so people are very clear about this, you know, last year alone there were 15 different rapes in these tent encampments, a significant portion of the population. We have every single year we take 12.5 tons of waste out from the tent encampments from our Department of Public Works. This year to date, homeless encampments have had over 7,000 311 calls, 55% increase over last year. There were 9 major fires last year, countless acts of not rape but other types of sexual assault. Anecdotally, we hear people that are not even living in them. They're being run as truly prostitution rings, as basically rooms, if you will. These are very, very dangerous places for people to live, and I do not believe that people are going to get on their own 2 feet by living in these tent encampments. And they're also very dangerous for people that have to either live around them or what have you. My proposition has met with outcry from someone on the far left. They run back to their phrase of criminalizing homelessness, which this is not doing. But it just goes to show you, from my perspective at least, what to me would be a very common sense thing, saying this is incredibly dangerous for everybody, those living in them in particular, those around the tents, and saying, we're going to say this is illegal, and we're going to remove them, but only once we can find them shelter housing, because that's where we need to get these people to. That has met with significant resistance. And I think it just goes to show kind of if there's ever inertia or what have you, there's very different political views on how to approach the issue. And what I believe to be common sense, they think is an awful idea. But that's our political system, the way we have it right now in the city.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point with time for just one last question. Don has been waiting patiently, and he fortunately is up next. So
no,
if we
I'm
can...
not patient. I'm glad to hear from Mark that San Francisco is not necessarily a magnet that draws in homeless people from other areas. But you mentioned that there are several proposals that would turn us into a magnet, and I'd love to hear a little bit about what are those proposals that we should avoid for that reason.
Sure. So I just mentioned Proposition Q, which I put on the ballot. Look, tents have become the embodiment, or I think a symbol of our homeless population over the last year or two in San Francisco. I put this on the ballot in response to some of my colleagues. Their proposals originally were that if you became a tent encampment of 30 or more tents, the city would be legally obligated to provide running water and bathroom facilities. That was one. And so that, to me, incentivizes the growth of tent encampments. Why would you not do that? And then the ones that are currently actually, one of them is going to be debated, likely this upcoming month, is one where my proposal says, we are going to take them down, but only once we can provide shelter or housing. Their proposal says, my colleague's proposal says, we will only take them down once we have permanent affordable housing for these individuals. So think about the consequences here. And I don't subscribe to today, this is people are market-driven to come to San Francisco. But if you were told, and you go from city to city, and you were told, come to San Francisco, put up a tent. The only time the city will ever take it down or harass you or make it uncomfortable for you is if they provide you lifetime government-subsidized affordable housing. From my perspective, we would become much more of a tent city than we are today. And we need to treat individuals with compassion. We need to be housing first. But there is a way to do it, and there's a way to do it that would incentivize this type of behavior and exacerbate the issue tenfold. And so that's, you know, my proposition Q that is on the ballot in November is very much in response to some of those ideas. But again, it will be heavily debated, and it's part of our political landscape. But I think those are, from my perspective, some of the things really to watch out for, lest our city turn gets really flipped upside down on this issue.
I just made 2 points, and then we can go home and have dinner. First of all, you're hearing it here, and it really is true. The bigger picture is we need to have activism from the state. This is a California problem. It goes up and down the coast, and it's coming into the Central Valley. And we need to have a cohesive homeless solution from the state, and it would make a big difference if we had an idea to do that. And the second thing I would say is, this is a little flippant, but the joke we keep hearing about these tent cities is the old story about the people who took in the stray dog, and they said, we're feeding it and we're giving it a warm place to sleep, but it won't go away. Well, we're giving these guys a great place to stay, and we need to find an alternative. And it doesn't work for anyone to have a tent encampment on the sidewalk or the streets of San Francisco. And that's what we need to do.
And let me also add that one of the ideas as well is that's currently on the table is that you would have to wait. You could only remove a tent encampment, A, once there's permanent affordable housing available for them, and second of all, you have to wait 2 weeks. Well, for some businesses, for some people's homes, that's not acceptable from the city of San Francisco's perspective. And so, again, I think that you're balancing absolutely first and foremost, housing first, compassion first, but also saying that some of these things that have creep up as a result of our homeless issue in San Francisco are just unacceptable, and that is a political hot button, to say the least.
Our thanks to Mark Farrell, Supervisor of San Francisco's District 2, CW Chuck Nevius, columnist with the San Francisco Chronicle, and Sam Dodge, Deputy Director of Policy and Communications for the San Francisco Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing. We also thank our audience here and our listening audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California in its 114th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.